is WNHNLP, broadcasting at 94.7 FM in Concord and WNHNFM.org on the internet. This is State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
And I'm Maggie Fogarty. And we continue to come to you from our Zoom studios. I'm in Dover, New Hampshire today. Arnie, where are you?
I'm in Canterbury, New Hampshire today.
And this is still State House Watch News. We've still got our eye on the goings-on of our state government as we respond to the COVID-19 crisis, as our legislature seeks to figure out how it can get its work done in this environment. Our newsletter will continue to come to you every Friday while the legislature is officially in session. And this radio show is a companion piece to that, broadcasting live on Mondays at 5 p.m., rebroadcast Tuesdays at 8 a.m.
And you can get the newsletter by going to our website at afsc.org/NH and look for that handy subscribe button. Now, Maggie, you mentioned the COVID crisis. I wonder if we are also experiencing a crisis of democracy right now, where our legislature has not been convening in regular session since the second week of March. There's a couple of committees that are working in a very kind of hesitant way, trying to make it possible for people to participate with each other across great distances in the state. The House and now the Senate as well have experimented with their first actual public hearings conducted over Zoom and YouTube, but it's still hard to figure out exactly how they're going to wrap up their business for the year.
Yes, it is surprising. It's confusing. It's disappointing that we are not getting more information about, and that more plans aren't being made public as to how the legislature, a very important branch of our government, will make itself relevant in this critical time and will complete any share of its work for 2020.
Well, we do know that the House is planning to meet at the Whittemore Hockey Arena at the University of New Hampshire in Durham on Thursday, June 11. And pretty much all we know about that meeting is that they're all going to be given masks. And otherwise, in terms of the procedures, it's really unclear. I think, Maggie, that what they're going to be focusing on are the bills that have gone to second committees within the House. And that means that those are bills that still have to get sent over to the Senate. The Senate, meanwhile, indicates that they are going to meet in Representatives Hall at the State House, but they have not even set a date yet. Their calendar for the coming week finally came out this morning, and it says nothing about a session. It mentions one committee meeting that's coming up. So it's really hard to tell exactly how they are going to finish up their work for the year.
I wish we knew more about what the obstacles are for them. I mean, as a smaller body, as a body that has staff, I have higher expectations for what they might be able to get done. I don't want to minimize the challenges, but it's a lot of silence and it's confusing and unsettling.
Well, I think that the senators are talking to each other at least, so that's they've got an understanding what their plans are. They have not disclosed it yet. We did speak to Senator Melanie Levesque, who chairs the Senate Election Law and Municipal Affairs Committee, and she indicates, as we've heard also from Senator Feltes a couple of weeks ago, the plan to put together some packages of omnibus bills so that there will be a smaller number of larger bills like the one that came out of the Senate Transportation Committee last Friday. But it's still a little bit murky how this is going to happen. Maggie, another thing that's a little bit murky is that last week, the leader of the House Republicans indicated that they were perhaps going to object to the process because they feel like they've been left out in the dark just as we have. And unless they feel like they are included or have disclosure of what the plans are, they might just block the rule changes that are necessary in order for the House to be able to function at all.
Speaker of the House, Steve Shurtleff, does respond that he has been reaching out regularly to Republican leaders in the House. So perhaps the complaint of there not being any overtures isn't entirely true, but I think it's understandable as a member of the public who's not understanding what's going on, that there might be frustration about how everything is proceeding and what will get left behind and whose voices are going to be heard.
Well, one thing that is at least clear in the House calendar for the coming week is that the Rules Committee is going to meet on Wednesday at 10 a.m. And I think that that is likely to be the place where proposals for rules to be laid down for how these unusual sessions are going to function will be made public and will pass one way or another. So that's something that we'll be keeping an eye on, and we'll let you know in our newsletter on Friday and on next week's radio show. One thing that we are expecting, Maggie, is that we will see some type of legislation going through focusing on the voting system, something that is of great concern right now at a time in which our city and town halls are largely closed. It's difficult for people to register to vote. We've got the governor and the secretary of state saying, if you're concerned about the danger of contracting the COVID virus or spreading the COVID virus from going to your polling place or to your city or town clerk's office, you can just claim to be disabled and qualify for a ballot that way. Well, that's the type of thing that might get clarified by legislation as it goes forward.
So what we're hoping for is language that allows someone to simply say that they have COVID-related vulnerability or fear that prevents them from being in person. Is that right?
I think that if that is clear by statute and not just by basically a news conference from the Secretary of State or a memo from the Secretary of State and the Attorney General that says that, I think it will be more clear for everybody, including the city and town clerks who have to administer these rules. Now, there are other things we can hope for, and that would have to do with what we might call no excuse absentee voting. Right now, you have to go through some hoops in order to get an absentee ballot. Obviously, if you're disabled, you can get an absentee ballot right now, but simply having to work that day, for example, if your polls are open from 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 p.m. and you need to leave by that time in order to get to work, that doesn't qualify you for an absentee ballot under current New Hampshire law. So clearly, these are things that need to get broadened out. And while other states are moving forward voting by mail, that's not something that New Hampshire has ever tried. And it's something that clearly is a direction that other states are going in and is warranted by the COVID crisis that we've got right now. So I think and I hope that we will see some legislation coming forward and getting to the governor that calls for those types of reforms and puts them on his desk in a way that he will feel that it is a good idea for the state to approve those bills and sign them.
Arnie, I believe I heard on the radio this morning that today is the deadline prior to the primary scheduled for September if someone needs to change their party affiliation. So,
right, you can change your party affiliation, and that can be done, I believe, by mail currently, although today was the deadline for doing that. And that was also under one of the governor's emergency orders that was issued some time ago now in this pandemic crisis. So there's changes that are getting made, but there are changes that were already warranted prior to this crisis that we're hoping people will have some better understanding of. You know, Maggie, in a way, there's a lot of things about flaws in our society and flaws in our systems that are perhaps becoming more clear to people. And we can look at the issue of police brutality and issues of disproportionate impact of our health system or ill health system on people of color as examples of that. Certainly the murder by Minneapolis police of George Floyd is something that has come to the fore most recently as one more reminder of a racist policing system in our country.
We are heartened to see such a substantial response all over the country and all over New Hampshire just this past weekend. What's reported, 1,000 people turned out in Manchester for the Black Lives Matter March on Elm. I saw reports of a couple of hundred people in the Conway region. We had folks, hundreds of people in the Upper Valley and then in smaller towns around the state. So people do seem to be growing in awareness of deep-seated racism of our institutions, our police systems, and other systems, and the importance that all of us step more fully into this crisis and bring a heart for policy change, education, relationship building, investments in communities.
Well, stay tuned to State House Watch for an interview with Rogers Johnson, who not only chairs the Seacoast branch of the NAACP, but also chairs the Governor's Commission on Diversity and Inclusion, and has just been named to be on a special COVID equity task force that the governor appointed last week. We'll also have an interview with Fiona Davis Walsh, a college student who lives in Albany, New Hampshire, where a recent disturbing incident took place. And she was one of the prime organizers of a demonstration that took place in Conway over the weekend in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. This is Statehouse Watch on WNHNLP. This is Sweet Honey in the Rock, Ella's song, based on the words of Ella Baker.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, black mothers' sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers' sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We believe in freedom cannot rest. That which touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people, passing on to others that which was passed on to me. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Sing it with us, come on.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. To me, people come first.
They come first.
They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light as they carry us through the gate. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. We who believe in freedom cannot clutch for power, not needing the light just to shine on me. I need to be one in the number as we stand against tyranny. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe struggling myself don't mean a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand and fight is the only way our struggle survives. Oh, oh, we who believe in a freedom and a freedom. I'm a woman who speaks
in a voice,
and I must be heard.
Senator Melanie Levesque chairs the Election Law and Municipal Affairs Committee. She spoke last Friday to Open Democracy's Granny D Legacy Committee.
I want to thank you for having me here. I love what you're doing. I did have an opportunity to meet Granny D when I first started out in politics, and she used to chum around with my mentor, Betty Hall. And I was just reading up about Granny D, just some of the things that she did. Like, she was so spirited and at such a young age to like try to defy the status quo. And she's done a great job of that and been a wonderful example and spurned people like you to step up and act. So I give her a lot of credit. I knew she was an amazing woman when I met her, but to have her legacy go on like this through you is truly amazing. So I want to thank your groups for their support, first of all, because I see Olivia in my hearings all the time, and she is considered an authority. So I many times defer to her and look for her opinion and her thoughts. So they're really important. And I know that some of the initiatives that you're working on, and so am I, things like getting money out of politics, you know, how do we ensure that we have elections with integrity? Things like redistricting, which is really important. My guiding light is that, you know, that I'm going to continue to work on things like getting money out of politics, disclosure, because I want to see those things. I think that's what's important. Voter-funded elections, I think that's important too, and I'll continue to work on that. But in the meantime, we do have to raise money. And so my guiding light is, do we share the same values? And the values and disclosing what you believe in to others, to me right now, is what's really important. I mean, I've returned checks from Liberty Utilities because I was, you know, very vocally standing up against the pipelines. I just recently turned in a check from Johnson & Johnson because we have a huge opioid crisis and they're part of it. I think that if you take money, it shows who you are and what you believe in. And again, we'll continue to work towards getting money out of politics, getting more and more disclosure, but it really depends on the people that you elect. You want to know about the elections. It looks like you're all doing okay during COVID. Right? Everybody's doing okay. Thank goodness. It has really rocked our world. We are basically thrown into the future, kind of like Star Trek. Pretty soon we'll be, you know, beaming ourselves somewhere. But you know, even though we use tools like Zoom through business for a web conferencing, and we do some learning through online tools, I mean, who would have ever believed that we would deliver all of our lessons, all of our schooling online like this? So it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's awful that we have to do this because of COVID, but I'm thankful that we have these tools that we can use. Today, I had my first hearing in transportation, and it went wonderfully, and it was all on Zoom. It's interesting because in the Senate and the House, we can't really be together. So the hearings are not so bad, but when we actually have session, we're going to be face to face. So the senators will go to Reps Hall, the representatives will go to the Whitmore Center, and sometime at the end of the month, we will be actually voting on bills to give to the governor. As far as the election bills and what's happening with our elections, we've been given $3.2 million from the federal government so that we can use that money. their suggestion was for mail-in voting, for ways to make our polls safer. And there is a select committee that is reviewing this, and I'm sure some of you have been on their calls. And the really amazing thing about these calls is that we're hearing from supervisors of the checklist, of clerks, just people who are passionate about integrity in our voting, and they know so much, and they have that, most of them seem to have that same goal of how do we make it safe for everyone to vote. So I'm really proud, even though I'm not sitting on the committee, I'm proud to hear all the feedback that people are giving. It gives me a lot of faith in our democracy. As you probably know, I sponsored bills like automated voter registration, online voter registration, joining ERIC. And I won't bother you with the bill numbers, but these are all bills that passed the Senate, and we would have brought them to the House. Actually, the automated voter registration has passed the House and Senate. We have to concur on it, but we're going to be bringing that in front of the governor soon so that we will see if he supports making it easier for people to vote. Because the session, because we can't be together and we have a lot of bills, what we've done is we've packaged the bills together. So we've created omnibus bills. And in the election arena, we're doing what I call is having an aspirational bill and then another bill, which is what the Secretary of State will let us do. And next week, we're going to be hearing the aspirational bill, which includes no excuse absentee voting. It includes online voter registration, also joining ERIC. That's the Electronic Registration Information Center. So it actually checks our voter checklist with, I believe it, there's 36 states now that are in it. So it checks our lists against each other. So if there's any duplicates, we know like this, you know, very quickly. This is another bill that I sponsored, which the Secretary of State said we didn't need, but it took them almost 9 months to figure out where the duplicates were. And as you can imagine, with an automated system, it doesn't take long at all to find out duplicates or fraudulent voting. But another bill that we're going to put in there in this aspirational omnibus bill is HB 556, which allows municipalities to actually process the ballots before Election Day. Now, we're going to get a lot of ballots for this election because the governor has said that anybody who does not feel comfortable during COVID can take an absentee ballot and mark themselves as disabled. We want to present that no excuse absentee ballot as the preference than to say that I'm disabled or I have to have a reason to vote absentee. So we have this aspirational bill, and you know, we're sure hoping that it will pass because with these things in place, we may not be able to get them put in place soon enough for this election, but had they been in place, they would have helped us to vote more safely, to register more safely. And we still think that it's a good idea to have these bills that will move New Hampshire forward.
You are listening to State House Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty with the American Friends Service Committee, and I'm in our Zoom studio this week with the president of the Seacoast NAACP, Rogers Johnson. Welcome, Rogers.
Good morning, Maggie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, and I'm glad for time to talk with you. I know that these are very demanding times for our leadership in communities of color and people working for racial justice. So I appreciate you having a conversation with us. Please, if you could, offer your commentary about this moment that we are living in nationally. What are you seeing around our country And then, of course, also right here in our own New Hampshire.
Well, Maggie, to be honest with you, I'm very sad. It's hard for me to imagine 2 weeks ago where we are today and have some understanding of why all this has transpired. I don't know why we've gotten to where we've gotten to, considering the fact that we've strived so hard over the last, I'd say, decade to make things right, and how things have gotten so far off the rails. It bewilders me. So if you have an understanding of it, you can clue me in, because right now I don't get it.
It's certainly very painful, and I think it's clear that a long period of pain and fear and anger is at the surface now and breaking out, as it has periodically multiple times over the last couple of decades, but that we are seeing the agony of people who live in fear and live in discrimination. And it is very painful. There is clearly so much work that we all need to do.
Well, Maggie, to take it one fine step forward, you can, I think you know this, I have taken great strides to form a relationship between people of color, the NAACP, and local police and state police over the last 4 years, and to see it all thrown to hell because of some actions by individuals in different parts of the regions of this country, it causes me pain to no end. We had budding, glowing relationships that are now called into question. And so I wonder, is it all for naught just to do that and to not really come away with anything? Do I have to start from scratch? Yeah, I don't know if I have the energy.
Well, thankfully, one thing that's given me some hope over the last couple of days is the enormous response. And in particular, there's some really impressive leadership among young adults, young people of color throughout the state. My children were at the Manchester Black Lives Matter march on Saturday, but I see hundreds came out in Conway and hundreds came out in the Upper Valley and then smaller actions around the state. Does that response give you some hope that there's energy and willingness to do the deep work that this painful reality requires?
Well, Maggie, what I'm encouraged by is the fact that the young people of this state, whose future, as far as they're concerned, has gone to hell. Excuse me for using that word, but if you're a young person in this state, exactly what is it that you have to look forward to, given what's been going on over the last 3 or 4 months? Well, they've stepped up to say they're not discouraged. They want to come together. And perhaps by doing so, maybe we do have a future. It's really the grown-ups that have taken it to a great extent to really mess things up. And perhaps we should just turn it over to them and let them run with it.
Well, why don't you talk about one of those groups of young people that I know you work particularly closely with, the Dover Dream Team, is it, that is hosting a vigil this evening in Dover?
That's right.
How did this group come about, and how are they responding to these struggles?
Well, Maggie, the reason why these guys came together was because of a racial incident that took place at Dover High School when a history/social studies teacher asked several members of the class to write a song parody, if you will, of the KKK during Reconstruction, which was wholly inappropriate and very insensitive, not just to the African-American kids in the class, but to the kids in the class overall. So these kids came together because they thought that they needed some representation, some presentation of themselves to the school and to the administration. So these kids have been working basically for the better part of a year now to bring awareness to the community and to their classmates about the issues of what it's like being Black in America. The reason why they're having this rally tonight is, as I had said before, these are individuals who are trying to recapture, to reemphasize the fact that we are all on this planet, sharing the same air, bleeding the same red blood, cherishing our children, as John Kennedy said, they recognize that. And so if they emphasize that, then we can all focus on our commonalities, except for the things that people want to divide us relative to the color of our skin.
Well, thank you for your support of them. I was, as a Dover resident myself, I was delighted to see that they had taken leadership to claim some space in all of this. And I understand their particular action is a vigil to honor the lives lost and our painful history. And of course, this is all playing out in the midst of a pandemic that has, as we know, and has been confirmed in multiple ways, disproportionately taken a toll on communities of color throughout the country and here. Do you want to comment? There's been an incident recently that I understand is under investigation by our state police and by leaders from the community involving an interaction with an immigrant man, a black man in Albany, New Hampshire.
Yes, a little bit more than a week ago, apparently an individual was stopped by the police and for whatever reason felt his life was in jeopardy, therefore he was not going to cooperate with the state police by turning over his license and or registration. So they took the unusual action of breaking down his window, car window, and pulling him out. Now, as rare as that seems, in the light of current day, that doesn't seem like it's an appropriate action. And so we've myself and Manchester President Jim McKim have started the process of investigating exactly what took place, who was at cause, what's going on here, so we get the full fact. And the most important thing here is to get the facts before anybody rushes to a conclusion. The key aspect is that the individual wasn't harmed. What's good about the New Hampshire State Police or most police in this state is that they react somewhat appropriately. They haven't harmed anyone. No one was shot, thank God. And so we can really be happy because of that. But the action in and of itself is somewhat troubling. But like I said, we're going to get to the bottom of it.
And it's the relationships that you have spent a great deal of time and energy investing in to strengthen, they come to bear in moments like this when tough situations unfold, as they will. You want to trust that our leaders in law enforcement are willing to look deeply and to respond appropriately and with transparency and a spirit of ongoing learning. So I just want to lift up that I appreciate the relationship building aspect as important to achieving real peace and real justice.
Maggie, the thing to take note here is that once this incident happened, I received a call from the Commissioner of Safety, from the Colonel who's in charge of the Uniform Police Division, from the Attorney General, everyone expressing their desire to work through the issue. I had both the commissioner and the colonel drive down from Concord to my house in Stratham to talk to me about this and what things that they could do to make this happen. Now, as you can imagine, that doesn't happen in any other state. That happens because we've worked hard to form this relationship, and it works with the fact that the police as a whole, whether it be county police or local police, recognize that these things are important, mainly because one other thing is true here. If something were to happen, the people who are going to be in the middle of it are going to be the police. They're going to be the people who we're going to be talking to see if we can help resolve these issues. Having a positive relationship with them is only a good thing. Can't be bad.
Yeah, well, amen. So thank you, because that's ongoing work too, just as there are many other aspects of this that will still be needed to be done, even as this particular set of tensions may die down. We have a lot of learning to do about our history, about our current practices, about things that, because of our own individual life experiences, we maybe have been trained not to see or need help to see. So it's a very appropriate spirit to bring to this
You're
work.
Talking about education there.
Yes, that's right. So you have been called recently to assist in another way as New Hampshire wrestles with institutional racism and disproportionate impacts, et cetera. The governor who had tapped you to serve as, were you the chair, Rogers, of his advisory council on diversity and inclusion?
I still am.
It's still, okay, good. So that's ongoing work. Well, he has reached out to you with a specific request in the midst of COVID-19. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, this was based off our letter issued by the Governor's Council on Diversity and Inclusion to Governor Sununu, highlighting that there are several aspects of this COVID virus that have disproportionately affected the community of color. Now, the thing to keep in mind here is that with all the things that are going on, and for the governor's staff, it's all COVID all the time. And you can imagine that they're pretty full up with the things that they have to do. It's also easy to imagine that there are certain things that have taken place that may have missed their view. It's not surprising because individuals, the majority, by that I mean white populace, doesn't look at certain aspects because it just doesn't occur to them. So the letter we wrote is saying, hey, you need to take a look at these things. And so this special committee formed just the other day is designed to highlight those aspects so that the state can now address them in a more appropriate fashion, mainly because it wasn't that they weren't looking, they just don't know.
And will you be, what do you foresee your process being? You've got a short timeline for an initial report to the governor. Do you plan to hear testimony? Are these going to be public meetings, one-on-one conversations, focus groups?
Because it's a public entity, we have to have some public meetings. I'm not sure how we're going to do that in this day of COVID. But the reality is the issues that we're talking about are known issues. This is not anything that's new. It's just that people haven't focused on it for a long, very long time. The aspect of people of color having disproportionate illnesses which is affected by COVID. Yes, people of color have higher blood pressure. They have higher rates of diabetes. They have higher heart ailments, kidney ailments, lungs. These things are known factors, but they've been known for a long time. So how do we then begin to address, how do we begin to mitigate these health risks within communities of color? What's more, there are other aspects based on the fact that people of color just don't have the assets to deal with this. For example, distance learning is tough when you don't have a computer. Distance learning is tough when you don't have access to the internet. How do we get organizations like Infinity provide computer access when they require a credit card in order to join? Many people don't have credit or credit cards. So how do those children then do distance learning? These are things that people need to come to grips with. And perhaps if we highlight these things, we can fix them. But not just for now, for the future.
Very good. Right. What's being revealed now, we have to, the work is not going to just be a 24-hour turnaround. You know, we have to look and understand what we're seeing and then commit ourselves to what will take significant and coordinated and strategic action to move the needle on. Who else is with you on this equity in a time of COVID task force or whatever its official name is?
Well, it's being chaired by Dr. Trini Telez, who works at the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Dottie Morris from Keene State University is on. And there are two other individuals who I do not know, but they both work in the healthcare field. Now, most people don't know this, but I got my master's in public health from UNH.
Oh, wow.
Back in 1999, which all that really means is that I'm pretty old. Having said that, again, my first career really was in healthcare, in healthcare policy primarily. So I'm not new to the subject matter. I've been basically doing this for the last 30 years.
Very good. Well, we will be watching that process closely and eager to see what gets lifted up and the policy recommendations, if there are some, the investment recommendations as we set aside and receive federal resources for this response. Thank you for what I'm sure will be a demanding couple of weeks as you serve in that capacity.
Just one more thing, Maggie.
Sure.
No. It's just one more thing to do.
Oh. Right. So thank you so much. I think I'll be sure to see you in Dover this evening at the Dream sponsored vigil at Henry Law Park at 8 p.m. And I'm sure I get the impression I'll see you in lots of places in the coming weeks and months. So thank you so much for all your giving.
You're welcome.
You are listening to State House Watch Radio on WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord, streaming at WNHNFM.org. I'm Arnie Alpert, and I am in the Zoom studio with Fiona Davis Walsh from Albany, New Hampshire. Fiona, welcome back to State House Watch.
Thanks so much for having me, Arnie.
Fiona, I understand that you and some of your friends organized a Black Lives Matter demonstration in downtown Conway, New Hampshire yesterday. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So River Hayes and Willa and Molly Canfield and I got together on Friday. I had called them up and said, I think we should do this, obviously in response to and in solidarity with protests happening across the country. And so we created a Facebook event and got people mobilized, and about probably a total of about 250 people ended up coming, which is the biggest by far that we've seen in Conway.
Right. For Conway, New Hampshire, that is a considerable outpouring of public concern.
Yeah. And definitely a lot of people I spoke to said, this is the first demonstration I've ever been to. It's a lot of folks who have never necessarily been involved in fighting against racism or fighting for other causes. And they're, you know, kind of finally waking up to the fact that as white people, no matter where we live, no matter who our friends and family are, no matter what our experience, we have a responsibility to do everything we can to work towards dismantling white supremacy in our lifetimes. We probably won't see the desired outcome in our own lives, but I'm excited to see these numbers of people finally realizing that it's their job and their responsibility to join this fight, even if they feel that racism doesn't impact or exist in their lives, because it exists within all of us. And it's especially important, I think, in rural areas for white people to do the internal work of combating racism and also do the external work of talking to friends and family, of challenging the system of racist policing in the United States, the systems of mass incarceration and systemic racism that exists in every area of our society. So it's hundreds of years too late, but I'm excited that we're mobilizing now, and I'm hopeful that this momentum will be sustained.
Fiona, can you say a little bit more about the local context for this demonstration, which is obviously about what's happened in Minneapolis and what's happened in Louisville and what's happening in Georgia and what's happening all over the country, but it is not distant from what's happening right in your own community?
Sure. So about 2 weeks ago, a man named J.R. St. Preux was pulled over by two white female police officers in Albany by the town hall. JR is Black, and he was accused of having an uninspected vehicle, and they broke his windows and violently pulled him out of the car and tased him. I don't know all the details of the incident. Obviously, I wasn't there. The cops have a very different story than JR does, and he's been hit with several charges, which will go to court on July 7th. But obviously, in this country, in this climate, and in this moment, it's impossible to separate racism from policing. It's impossible to separate racism from the way that Black people are policed in this country, no matter where they live, no matter whatever the reason they might be pulled over, whatever the reason they might be arrested, the way that police treat Black people, Indigenous people and people of color, but especially Black people, is tied strongly to racism. And so we can't speculate on this incident, but we know the way that JR was treated was violent and unnecessary, and that he feels, as he has said, he feels traumatized by the incident. And so I think for many folks, this might have been a wake-up call in that people in this area like to assume or pretend that racism doesn't exist here because it's a primarily white area, or that racism doesn't touch us because we're far from areas where it's so blatant and so constant. But yeah, I think this incident and the treatment by those police officers of JR was a reminder to people that it happens everywhere, present everywhere, and it's all of our job to question and challenge and ultimately overhaul this racist system.
Fiona, this was not your first wake-up call, because I know that when you were a high school student just a couple of years ago, you were involved in some similar types of organizing and community education.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to have parents who have been working on this since long before I was born, and who have sought to educate me and hold me accountable for my entire life. So yeah, when I was in high school, we sought through demonstrations and through creating groups at Kennett High School on issues of justice to educate our community. But obviously that is long, hard, and ongoing work. And so I'm excited to see folks who never showed any interest before finally engaging and realizing that this is all of our responsibility as white people.
It's very interesting right now, in a time when many of us are trying to avoid going out of our homes at all, to have so many people, and as you describe it, people coming out to a demonstration in the streets for perhaps the first time ever. So I think that's very exciting and gives me some hope. I'm curious if you can say a little bit about what's next in your community that you're involved with, and also if there are, in this terrible time that we're in right now, if there are sources of hope that you are finding.
Sure. First, I do want to say a little bit about the context that you mentioned, because I think it is telling that folks decided to prioritize this. We made clear that we were prioritizing the health of protesters. We asked everyone to wear masks and keep their distance from those not in their close circle of family and friends. And people did that. People remained safe and respected each other's boundaries. But I was glad to see so many people come out, because as we've heard over and over, and as is true, racism and police brutality are health crises that have existed for hundreds of years and that existed long before this pandemic. So to see people realizing that and deciding to put their bodies out there, even given this climate and given the risks, was heartening. So yeah, our next steps here include holding people accountable to the values that they appear to have given their participation, including redistributing resources. So giving money in a significant and sustained way to frontline organizations that are founded and led by Black people, Indigenous people, and people of color, including the Black Visions Collective, National Bailout, the Reclaim the Block, Unicorn Riot. These are organizations that are providing immediate assistance to people who need bail, to people who need food and housing. To these organizations are trying to reimagine this country, reimagine these systems that were founded on racism and racist violence. So trying to hold people accountable to their values by redistributing the resources that we as white people have earned in part due to hundreds of years of racist violence and, or I shouldn't say earned, you know, we, our place in society and our resources are in large part due to our race, due to the fact that our race has never been an obstacle to us. And so trying to redistribute those resources in a way that reflects the values that we claim to have is a really substantive and important way that we can try to live our values. Of course, it's not the only thing. We have to be constantly doing the internal work of reading, journaling, listening to scholars and activists who are doing this labor many times for free, on the internet, on the radio, on television, in through movies and books. We can't call on our loved ones, our friends and family of color to educate us. That's not their job. So part of our work here is going to be compiling reading and watching lists, compiling lists of organizations that people can learn from and give money to, and forming book groups, reading groups, forming groups of people to work on different aspects of this and hold our community accountable to different aspects of this. We're hoping to get books for all ages into schools that not only are written by and feature Black, Indigenous, and people of color, but normalize their existence, their joy, their right to survive and thrive in this country, because so often we simply don't have books for children featuring people of color, or we have them, but only about the civil rights movement, or only about these issues or these one-time events that we as white people associate with Black, Indigenous, and people of color. But I hope that through diversifying every level of our education, beginning in preschool and going through elementary school and high school and into adulthood for people of all ages, I hope that we can bring folks into this work in a way that's lifelong.
Well, Fiona Davis Walsh, I'm glad to see that while we are physically distant from each other, that you are staying socially connected to people in your community and urging people to continue to work together. Thank you for your own witness and education to trying to overcome and overturn this system of racist violence that you've been describing. Thanks for being with us on Statehouse Watch.
Thanks so much, Arnie. Black Lives Matter.
You've been listening to Statehouse Watch Radio with me, Maggie Fogarty, and my co-host, Arnie Alpert, on WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord. Visit WNHNFM.org for podcasts of all of our past shows, as well as Fred Portnoy's Ancient and Modern, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Portraits in Blue and Green with Frank Wilner, and The Dave Scott Show. Join us again next week, and remember, there's a bright side somewhere.
Well, there's a bright side somewhere. There's a bright side somewhere. And I ain't gonna rest until I find